Is the China deal a repeat of the investiture controversy? Steve Weidenkopf is next. Hello, and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. The long history of the Catholic Church means that the Church has faced almost every kind of political question or crisis or whatnot, but we're in one again in China, a political difficulty for the Church in China, dealing with the communist government of China, trying to figure out how the Church can defend its rights and its people in China, particularly because China is an expressly atheist state that wants everything under the control of the government, including churches. Lots of folks have suggested that Pope Francis has kind of slipped into an investiture controversy here with the Chinese government, allowing the Chinese government to have way too much say in who can be a bishop in China. Well, that does sound a lot like what happened in the 10th and 11th century in Europe. So we decided to get a historian, a church historian, to talk with us about the investiture controversy and ask him, is that like what's going on in China right now? Here's what Steve Weidenkopf had to say. Steve Weidenkopf from the Graduate School of Theology at Christendom College. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Sy, for having me on the show.
And congratulations again on your new book, Light from Darkness, 9 times. The Catholic Church was in turmoil and came out stronger than before. We wanted to talk a little bit about China, and it struck me one of the chapters in here on the investiture controversy kind of makes us think about the situation in China today. And I started looking what people were saying, and quite a few people have compared them. And one, I was reading one by a guy named Will Inboden, who writes for the Financial Times. I believe this was in the Financial Times. And he ends his article, he's concerned that this is before the Pope made his agreement with China. And he ends the article with this sentence about his concern about what Pope Francis is up to. Francis might be gratuitously giving away to Beijing the hard-won gains of Gregory VII at Canossa almost 1,000 years ago. And I was like, what? That's quite a connection to make. So how about we talk about the investiture controversy, and then we talk about, is that related to what's going on in China today?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's when you mentioned that quote from the reporter there, it reminded me of a quote that Bismarck allegedly said back in the 19th century during his efforts to unify the different areas of Germany into a German empire. He made a similar kind of comment. He said, "We will not go to Canossa." Meaning that we will not kowtow to the Church, if you will, or to the Pope,
right,
in matters of politics and of state and what have you. So,
and they didn't.
No, he certainly did not in the culture conf during the 19th century, and even later in German history. But yeah, so what is the investiture controversy? I mean, it is kind of a bold statement for a modern day reporter to make about, you know, referencing an event that happened, you know, geez, almost years ago now. Was this investiture controversy? Well, to understand it, you really have to have a little bit of background of what's going on in Christendom here towards the end of the 5th century, right? So we know at the end of the 5th century, governing authority from Rome, the Western Roman Empire, collapses.
Yeah.
And instead, political power then devolves down to a more regional and more local levels. And that power really begins to be centered on what were, at the time, ethnically Germanic but Romanized auxiliary commanders, right? Commanders of auxiliary Roman military troops. And so these warriors then become the kind of political players of the day. And as the centuries progress till you get to the 9th and 10th centuries of Europe, you still have these warriors, right, who are really the political authority in the world, along with the Church. And so what happens is, once you have the kind of collapse, if you will, then of another empire, the Carolingian Empire under Charlemagne and his sons, and the devolution of European political power into even more regional factions and whatnot, you have this situation that erupts where you have the Church and bishops become very involved in political affairs, and bishops themselves become to be seen by these secular lords and rulers and kings as functionaries of royal government, if you will. And so in the Germanic lands in particular, what happens is the king is apt to appoint bishops and utilized them basically as royal administrators. So they serve both an ecclesial function and a secular function. Mm-hmm. And so you have the German kings then begin to see that one of their functions of royal government is to appoint bishops. Now, a man who is appointed to be bishop isn't ordained by the king. Let's make that clear, right? I mean, to be a bishop, you have to be ordained by other bishops, and that still did happen. But what develops in these German territories is this ceremony known as investiture, where the feudal symbols of office or the secular symbols of office were given in a ceremony. And these symbols were a sword or a spear and given by the royal official or the king himself to the bishop, man who's going to be the bishop. And then also, along with the secular symbols, in the same ceremony, he is given or was given the symbols of ecclesial authority. So same symbols that a bishop uses today for his office, his crozier, the staff, and the ring. And so that began to be seen, though. You can see, though, in the situation, in the ceremony, the two kind of can somewhat collude together, right? So this the impression is given or the perception is given, is the king giving the authority and power to be a bishop along with the authority and power to be a secular lord?
Right.
And how does that – what does that have to do with the authority of the pope and the church as a whole, right? So as we get into the 11th century, especially towards the end of the 11th century, you have a series of papal reformers. So monks who leave the monasteries and then become elected pope, or they're elected pope, and they want to free the church from secular interference.
Yes.
And so they center their initiative on this investiture ceremony, right? They want to free the church from secular interference, and one way in which they can do that, or one way they want to do that, is to ban investiture by secular officials. And so when the monk Hildebrand is a reformer, one of these papal reformers, eventually is elected pope as Pope St. Gregory VII, he in 1075 issues a ban against investiture that can't be done on pain of excommunication.
And who would be excommunicated, the king or the official or the bishop?
Basically all three, all of the above in essence, right?
Okay.
I mean, it's directed at the secular lord, and it's also later on directed towards those who actually allow themselves, if you will, or accept investiture by a secular lord. They also are excommunicated. Now, what made this unique and why Gregory is kind of seen as this focal point in history is Gregory not only says, you know, sure, the man who accepts investiture is excommunicated, we can excommunicate the king, but he took it a step further, and his understanding of papal power was that the pope was not just someone who was a moral teacher of secular rulers, like kind of teaching them or exhorting them what's right, what's wrong, but he was also a judge, a moral judge of kings and of secular rulers. So in his mind, when he issued a decree of excommunication to a secular lord, he then also freed that king's subjects from their oaths of loyalty and fealty to the king.
Oh yeah.
So in essence, he allows for legitimate rebellion.
So this is a big, big deal that you don't want to be the king and get excommunicated, and then the people are because they drew their legitimacy from a kind of religious view of the world that said and it comes from St. Paul's letters, I'm sure too, and from Jesus himself in rendering unto Caesar that secular authorities, and even today we would say this teaching didn't change. Secular authorities do have a role in God's divine plan, and we do have to subject ourselves to them.
Right, absolutely, right. In their own sphere, right, in the secular sphere, they have authority and power, and you know, is given by God, and that, yeah, it's as long as that power is exercised legitimately, then we have an obligation to, you know, be good citizens and to, you know, abide by their power and their legitimate power and authority. And so, when Gregory comes along and says, you know, hey, if I excommunicate the king, that frees his subjects from loyalty to him. This one thing we have to keep in mind is that in this period of time, right, kings are not as we kind of conceive of them usually, right? We in the modern world, when we tend to think of kings, we think of absolutist monarchs, right, which really didn't come into European history until much later, men who had absolute control over everything in their kingdom, right? Medieval kings kings were not like that at all. They were really, in essence, a kind of a first among equals. There were a lot of barons and counts and dukes and others who wielded extreme amounts of power and authority and influence in their own areas, and who took oaths of loyalty and fealty to the king, and so recognized his authority and lordship with parameters. So if the Pope comes in and says, you know, the king's been excommunicated and that has now freed his subjects from their oaths of loyalty, that allows these powerful counts and dukes and other secular lords to then, you know, bring about a rebellion, overthrow the king, and even establish themselves on the throne as king. So it's a very serious situation for the ruler, for the king.
Okay, so is this the church? I mean, I suppose part of this article and some of the other articles that talk about China in the investiture controversy say what the principle the church was defending was the separation of church and state. Is that a proper way to think about this?
I wouldn't necessarily argue it that way. I mean, I hesitate because the whole concept of separation of church and state is really, you know, it's a modern kind of American concept, and it there's a lot of baggage associated with that phrase anyways, right? In the American political life. So I'm always, you know, as a historian, kind of hesitate to apply modern day labels and modern day definitions of things right to the past.
Right.
But it was not necessarily a separation in how we view it. I would argue that we could say it was a separation in terms of you have authority and and power in your sphere, and we have authority. The church has authority and power in its sphere.
Yes.
And sometimes the church's authority and power and influence would extend beyond its sphere, sort of sense, because it encompasses the entire world. What Gregory the Seventh would argue, right? He is later on it would be Pope Innocent III. Who would use this title more definitively and more frequently, that the Pope is the vicar of Christ, right? He's Christ's representative on earth, and therefore his power and his authority extends throughout the universal world and the church as a whole. Gregory maybe had a nascent belief and understanding of that, not as he wouldn't have used the term vicar of Christ, right, as Innocent III did, but his understanding of his power and authority was that I am the moral judge of secular rulers. So when they are doing something that's inappropriate or wrong, you know, then the Pope can issue, by his authority as Christ's representative, can issue a ban on certain things that they are doing and then excommunicate him. And that's what he did here with the church. He thought that what King Henry IV, who was the king of the Germans at the time, who was doing this, that it allowed him too much influence and power within the church. And Gregory and other reformers wanted to see that end.
And what was the problem that they thought they would be addressing? I mean, the king was Catholic. He's not, I mean, it doesn't seem like he would want to, you know, he's not trying to introduce some, you know, some new theory of governance into the world. And it had been done before for centuries. So what was the problem that people like Gregory saw? What was it that they were trying to solve by establishing this, the clarity that we appoint bishops, you don't?
Yeah, great question. And two aspects to answer that from their view, why they saw this as a bad thing. Well, the first is fairly simple to explain, is that the secular rulers, especially the king of the Germans, used bishops, right, not only as as ecclesial lords, if you will, but they were also secular lords, and so used them for royal administrative functions. And usually, and in many cases, if there was a political conflict between the Pope and the king, these bishops frequently would side with the king over their loyalty to the church, mm-hmm. because they owed both their secular and their secular office in particular to the king, and then even, you know, a lot of their just day-to-day functions and authority in their diocese was kind of owed in essence to the king as well, since they had been picked by him to be the bishop. And so that caused the bishop, or the Pope rather, concerns, right? In a conflict with bishop or between Pope and king, many of these German bishops sided with the king and not the Pope. So that causes disunity in the church and a problem. So that's one issue. The second reason why they really wanted to get rid of this issue or get rid of secular interference in appointing of bishops and in doing this investiture ceremony is A little bit before this time, about 20 years or so before the investiture controversy, you have a change in how the Pope is elected. So in 1059, Pope Nicholas II passes or promulgates the decree on papal elections where he centers the election of the papacy on the College of Cardinals. Mm-hmm. Before that, it actually had been the emperor who would nominate the Pope, and then the people and clergy of Rome would acclaim the Pope. And even before that, it was just the people and clergy of Rome. But what happens in the 9th century and into the 10th centuries is that you have, because of the political situation we talked about earlier in Christendom, especially in Italy, you have all these various Italian families and noblemen vying for control of the papacy. And so they would put their own candidates on the throne, and we had a series of popes who were less than virtuous, men who were not suitable candidates for the office at all. And so, as I mentioned, Hildebrand was one of these reformers of the church who was part of this great papal reform movement of the 11th century, started by St. Leo IX, continued on by Gregory and others even after him, to get rid of many ecclesiastical abuses that were prevalent in the 11th century, like simony and clerical sexual immorality. That was one stage of the reform, if you will. A second stage of the reform was to secure the independence of the church via the papacy by getting rid of secular rulers. So they saw this fight, and Hildebrand or Gregory VII did, as an extension of the, you know, preservation of the papacy from secular interference. It extends now to bishops as well.
So how does this controversy get resolved? Because the kings don't just go, oh, sorry, Pope, we overstepped our bounds. You go ahead, right, Gregory. Do what you need to do. How does this get resolved?
Yeah, well, the initial conflict between Henry and Gregory is a dramatic story. It would make a fantastic movie if actually told correctly. But which is, you know, doubtful today, but sadly. But what happens is, right, Gregory issues this ban. Henry, the king, is very upset with this, but it frees his subjects from loyalty. Many powerful dukes and counts begin to then say, well, you know, maybe we could get rid of the king and one of us could be king. And so it causes him problems. So he decides, this is where Canossa comes in. He decides to Henry to travel to the castle of the Countess Matilda of Tuscany in Canossa in the northern Italy, where Pope Gregory VII has traveled to winter over, because many of the German barons and counts and dukes have invited him to come to Germany to address this issue between him and Henry. And so Henry hears that the Pope is in this castle in Canossa, decides to travel over the Alps during the winter with a small retinue, appears in at the castle kind of with penitential clothing, and knocks on the door and wants to be forgiven by Gregory. And so it's a very dramatic scene. Gregory actually keeps the king waiting outside in the snow for 3 days before he allows him entrance into the castle. Many different theories as to why he did that. But anyways, he gets into the castle and he forgives him, right, as priest to penitent. He forgives him for his disobedience, but does not restore him to the throne. Oh. Right? That was to be decided later on in a diet, in a meeting of the German nobles that he was supposed to attend. He never actually ends up going to that, though. Henry goes back. He puts down the rebellion, reestablishes authority. And once he's established his authority, he reestablishes authority as king. He then raises an army and marches down to Rome and attacks the city. Eventually, Gregory VII then has to seek military assistance and aid from the Normans, who are in the south of Italy. They launch an army up to Rome. Henry hears of the approach of the Norman army. They're more powerful than him. So he says, well, I got what I want. I'll leave now. And he leaves the city and goes back to German territory. Normans come into the city with a large contingent, frankly, of Muslim troops who then sack the city. And the Roman people blame Gregory for the sack, and he ends up having to flee Rome, and he dies in exile. So not a great end of the story for Gregory himself.
No.
So this controversy continues on even into the 12th century. It's not really until the 1122 at a meeting at Worms, where a concordat was signed between the Pope Callistus II at the time and the later king, where they agree that the symbols of the secular office will be granted by a secular official, and the symbols of the ecclesial office will be granted by a church official, an ecclesial official. And then eventually that agreement is ratified at the First Lateran Council in 1123, and it kind of ends the conflict there between the German king and the popes. But this whole notion of who appoints a bishop, and how is that allowed, whether it's a secular ruler, whether it's the people, whether it's the pope, continues on in church history. I mean, we see this come about even, later centuries, during the French Revolution, for example, the French revolutionary government, when they took over the church in the 1790 Constitution of the Clergy, advocated or called for the government appointing bishops, and the Pope having to basically accept those nominations and those appointments. Later on, Napoleon would sign a concordat with the church where he would nominate the bishops, and the Pope would then approve. He had veto power, but would approve the bishops that Napoleon nominated. So I guess, if you will, that kind of leads us into, I know what we want to discuss is kind of the current situation in China, which is, again, a kind of a similar situation where you have the government wanting to control the church in certain ways through the appointment of bishops. And the church, because of the political situation that it sees itself in at various times, has to make accommodations in certain senses, in certain ways because of it.
So, and has, though, since the investiture controversy, it has not always been the case that the Pope alone or the church alone decides in every case who is the bishop in every see. That is not at all how the church has functioned in the intervening centuries.
That's correct. Right. It's really not until you get into, post-Italian unification, into the 19th century, where you really begin to see the solidification, and even into the, 20th century, really, where you begin to see the solidification of the power of the nomination of bishops, if you will, and their appointments kind of, devolving centrally to the Pope.
And so when we think of some of the 20th century concordats, like with Mussolini, is the concern there that the church maintains her liberty to function, not so much that she wants to be in a relationship with Mussolini, but if you're going to function in Italy, you got to deal with Mussolini, so you make a concordat with him. That's how it works?
Exactly. Yeah. So as Pope, Pius XI in particular, through his pontificate, you see a whole series of concordats that are signed right in the 20th century with various governments. So you have the concordat with Italy. You have a concordat with, the famous concordat in 1933 with Germany, with the Nazis, and how that was, which was being negotiated before the Nazis came to power. But it was, these concordats were designed to allow for the continuing operation of the church within the legal framework of the existing governmental system. So it's not as if the church, when she signs these concordats, is saying, we agree with everything that this regime represents, we agree with the ruling political parties or whatever. It's a legal document, or was supposed to be a legal document, that provided a framework with which for the church to continue to operate legally and freely, and then also to have a recourse with which to to bring forth, whenever the government or others were encroaching on the church and her rights and her responsibilities, a legal framework for her to complain about that.
And then after all the fascism goes out, we still have the Iron Curtain. But there are still Catholic priests. Certainly we know about Poland because we got a pope out of communist Poland. So was it similar there? They functioned by these core concordats or diplomatic arrangements, or how did that work?
Yeah, I think it varies by country and by situation. So not always, right? Not every country, the church didn't enter into concordat with every country. She did so just in certain circumstances and with certain countries, mostly in Europe. And then it's really not until, as you mentioned, Mussolini, it's not until 1929 where you have the establishment, or you have the Lateran Treaty that establishes Vatican City State, where you actually have now the church recognized as a independent sovereign, independent nation city state, if you will. And so then certain countries would enter into diplomatic relationships with, what we call the Vatican, Vatican City today. But some countries haven't, right? I think it wasn't even until the Reagan administration, maybe, that the United States actually officially recognized diplomatically Vatican City State. So, it's a similar situation with, I guess, communist countries and things like that. It depends on each country and each interaction with each country, whether they wanted to recognize that the Vatican diplomatically or not.
So, which brings us to China today, which is kind of a holdout from what is generally a liberal, in the broad sense of the term, movement around the world where you have elected governments and all that. China, I don't know, 1.5 billion people or something. Not that way. But you're saying that this is not a situation that's exactly analogous to what happened at the investiture controversy.
No, I mean, I think that I'm not a specialist or anything in what's going on in China and the church's relationship with China. But from what I understand, right, there's especially recently with what Pope Francis, I think, is trying to do is again, establish some kind of framework or agreement with the existing government with which the church can operate in a legal manner and in a manner that is at least free from certain levels of persecution. I know that there's, you know, the establishment, obviously, of the Patriotic Church there with the government appointing bishops. And, you know, now at least with the agreement that Francis signed, is my understanding that now at least the Pope has a role in approving those appointments and has a say in who is made a bishop in China and who is not. And then you have the case, obviously, of the underground bishops who aren't members of the Patriotic Church. And the agreement, my understanding again, was to try to find some way in which to normalize their relationship with the government of China without having to become members of the Patriotic, you know, Church as well, or at least members of the party and seen as government, or government officials or those kinds of things, right? Or at least be beholden to the government. So it's a delicate balance, right? Because you have this communist government, which up until, I think it was not until 1979 that the communist government in China actually even recognized that there could be anything other than atheism in China. So, you know, there is this complex reality culturally as well as politically of what's going on in China that the church has to operate and deal with.
So what I want to kind of establish with you then is that there might well be many pragmatic objections to what Pope Francis has done, but on principle he's not simply surrendering the gains the church has made at places like Canossa. That's not a fair.
Right. I would. That's exactly right. I would say that's not a fair assessment to criticize. I think Pope Francis in that regard, right, and say that the church is just giving into the government, and allowing the government to control the church, because the church, as I mentioned, right, in other centuries, not in the too distant past, has had to make similar kinds of concessions in order for the freedom of the ability to operate, the freedom to be able to continue to minister to Catholics in those countries, and to provide for their sacramental needs, along with dealing with the political situations that the church finds herself in, at being, not only a pastoral organization, if you will, but also recognized in the secular world as a sovereign city-state.
In some ways, I said we might make a practical or prudential objection to what the Pope has done in China, but I suppose in some ways we don't even actually know the fullness of what's, because some of it is still secret. We don't know entirely what's been agreed there. So I don't want to dissuade anyone from criticizing that. That's not the point, but the point is that the investiture controversy is a very specific controversy, and we're not reliving that in China.
No, I don't think so. I think it's more of a function of the investiture controversy was very unique to the feudal system and the political system that existed in Christendom at the time. And so although it's been used, as I mentioned, at the top of the show here with Bismarck and his comment of we're not going to go to Canossa, people continue to use that and see the investiture controversy and the relationship between Henry and Gregory and apply it in their own modern context or whatever context they're trying to – political context they're trying to compare it to. And I think in general, I guess you can kind of make that statement, say, well, if it's a situation between, the independency of the church vis-a-vis secular government control – okay, you can kind of make that generalization or that general linkage, but we have to be mindful of the historical context before we walk down the path of trying to apply it in more specific terms and criticize the church for something that is not at a fair comparison.
So one of the things that I really like about your book, Light from Darkness, Nine Times the Catholic Church Was in Turmoil and Came Out Stronger Than Before, is you always end on, okay, so we went through the investiture controversy, for example, and actually things didn't just go back to the way they had been or some ideal of the past. They got better. These things led to advance. So when you look back at the investiture controversy and all that happened there. What got better? What did the church gain from the investiture controversy?
Yeah, well, what I try to do in the book is draw that the church got better from that controversy. Specifically, if you fast forward into the 13th century with the pontificate of Pope Innocent III, right? So the late 12th and early 13th century, you have the rise of Innocent III, who was perhaps the first – he was the first university-educated pope. He was – you kind of move from reformist popes into kind of lawyer popes, I guess, with his pontificate. And so he really begins to establish a nice legal framework work for the church that clearly delineates and identifies the spheres between the secular and the spiritual sphere. Innocent also is the one, as I mentioned earlier, who wants to use and uses frequently the title the Vicar of Christ. And so when you reach his pontificate, he is receiving the fruits of all of the struggles of the papal reformers before him. So he is recognized with clear and distinct and independent authority by secular rulers throughout Christendom. Now, again, they don't always listen to him. Like the knights, he's the pope who called the Fourth Crusade, who sadly ultimately ended up sacking Constantinople, which wasn't his intent at all. And so the barons and knights on that crusade didn't listen to him saying, don't go to Constantinople. So I don't want to paint a picture that, his pontificate meant everybody in Christendom was listening and obeying everything the Pope said. That still didn't happen. But Innocent very much established an independent papacy that had far-reaching power and authority, which I think was a good thing for the church. Many times people paint, especially other historians and medievalists, paint Innocent III in a bad light. They see him as this kind of power-hungry clergyman and someone who didn't respect the separation of church and state, as we would call it in today's world. And so it was they see him kind of as this power-mongering cleric. But he was more than that, right? He was a man who deeply loved the church, and he wanted the church to remain independent. And he understood the power that he had within the papacy that had been given to him through all these different reformers before him. And he took advantage of that, if you will, and he used it to further the gospel and to protect the independence and the independent structure and nature of the church, if you will, in the world.
Again, I just want to let people know the name of the book again, Light from Darkness, 9 times the Catholic Church Was in Turmoil and Came Out Stronger Than Before. The author is Steve Weidenkopf, who has been our guest. Steve, thanks very, very much. It's always just great to talk with you.
Thanks. I appreciate you having me on the show again. Good to talk to you.
If you want to know more about the investiture controversy or many other controversies that have enveloped the Catholic Church over its long history, you can get Light from Darkness, 9 times the Catholic Church Was in Turmoil and Came Out Stronger Than Before, from Steve Weidenkopf. A lot of turmoil now, a lot of reason to hope that the church will come out stronger than before when it's all over. Hey, if you want to support us, you can do that by going to givecatholic.com. Give in any amount, and that helps us to keep the lights on and keep the cameras rolling for this podcast. givecatholic.com. If you're listening on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or any of the other podcast apps and whatnot, if you wouldn't mind, give us a 5-star review and maybe say a few nice words about the podcast. We're trying to grow it, and that helps us to grow it. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.